Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled The Liberations and Limitations of Genre, and it's about sort of musical genres and the way they both help and, I think, inhibit expression. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows a little something about musical genres, Mr. John Charney. Hello.
Hello.
Say something for yourself.
I'm really happy to be here, and considering the fact that we're underneath this tree and we could be struck by lightning, this may be the last thing people hear from us. So
yes.
Let's make it good, Matt.
Yes, let's make it good. And I think we should explain exactly where we are. I think you could best explain where we are.
We are in the spot I will be buried someday, which is Loretto Graveyard of Loretto, Pennsylvania. It's actually situated kind of on a hill behind, which is the Church of St. Mike's, which is actually a basilica now. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes.
From your days of yore of Loretto scamperings. You know, now it's a basilica. So I really like this place. It's peaceful. And I think it's why we chose this location. So, we're outside and it's raining and there's thunder, as if you couldn't hear that by now. So,
and there's like dead bodies really nearby. And
like to your left?
Yeah, yeah. No, Dennis J. Klatt, who, it's only 1969 to 1990.
Yeah,
math on that's not big. Yeah.
No, I mean, I wonder what happened. I wonder if it was some kind of bizarre gardening accident or farming thing. You know, but no, I mean, like 1990 is when I was my freshman year at St. Francis. So
you see, so there we go.
You know what's crazy is he that headstone was not there when I first started coming here to do my homework. So he was buried here, I guess, maybe. I mean, I guess he died in July that year, and then probably months after that, I saw there was a stone here. But yeah, I used to come here and do my homework instead of in the halls of St. Francis. So
it's a mighty fine place to do it.
It's quiet, unless it's thundering.
Yeah. In fact, I do have memories of, I think, ditching out on some freshman orientation activity and coming up here. Like, this was one of the first.
I didn't go to any of that either. I found it to be probably not the best thing for me.
Yeah.
And it was hot.
Yeah.
No, we hate hot weather.
Yes.
So I'll blame it on the heat, and as will you. So we're off
the
hook.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So there's a big part of what you do and who you are that, you know, is you're a musician. You, how many bands are you in? How many musical projects are you involved in, like, right now?
I'd have to say definitely two. I'm involved in Wine of Nails still, which is just an original instrumental project.
Yeah.
More geared toward recording and creation rather than live performance, because we all know how easy it is to get gigs as an original instrumental act.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially in West Central Pennsylvania, where artistic expression is so rampantly confusing.
Yeah.
So I'm involved in that. And then also I have this project going on with Gabby Herzog, and she's a vocalist from around here, and we do all original stuff, and we do some covers, and we play out occasionally. That's more of a gigging thing, but it's more acoustic duo, and we're actually going to be recording our first album in a couple weeks or so.
Oh, wow. So, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're also, though, a musical director, too.
At Bishop Carroll.
Yes.
Yeah, at Bishop Carroll High School in Ebensburg, Pennsylvania. I'm not the band director or anything. I just, as the thunder fades, I'm the music director for the musicals. The first one was in 2012. We did Schoolhouse Rock Live. Then we did Wedding Singer last year. And then we did Little Shop of Horrors this year. And it really turned out to be quite fruitful on many levels.
Cool.
I mean, like, I started with Kenny Rosinski in 2002, our dearly beloved Kenny Rosinski.
Yeah.
I don't know if we approached him. I can't remember now because it's 12 years ago now.
Yeah.
About doing an album, or I'm sorry, a musical show, a musical based upon my band, Wine of Nails' music, off our album On and Beyond. And it was essentially a show which had no dialogue, maybe just a little bit. But, you know, it's the whole theme of being an instrumental band and how we could convey that in a musical. And that's really where I got my start. And then 2 years later, Lori Hauser, actually another friend of ours, asked me to do little, Rocky Horror Show.
Yeah, Rocky Horror Picture Show, yeah?
Yep, at Crescent Lake Playhouse, and I did two more there, and then I did one in State College in 2007, so I had a run of like four straight Rocky Horror Shows. Yeah. So that's where I got my start into theater, musical theater, and just from doing Rocky, you really gain an appreciation for what goes into that kind of art form, because you not only have music, you have acting, you have dancing, movement, lighting, all kinds of amazing things going on at once, and it takes a special talent to be able to pull that off, and I Absolutely. Truly respect the people I work with that do that kind of work, so yeah, I do the Bishop Carroll thing too.
Yes, and you also teach, right?
Yes, I teach guitar. I've been doing that for probably about 17 years, and then I built it all off the ground, all through word of mouth. I've never advertised. Wow. We're going to get hammered here, folks.
Yes. I'm sure that sounds great. Oh, yeah, that just clipped the mic.
Did it?
Yes.
Oh,
that's
man.
Great.
I'll tell you what, people are really going to appreciate this after we die.
Yes, so. After we're dead, as long as it doesn't fry the hard drive of the laptop.
Right.
It's going to be the most popular, you know, it'll be one of those like Gawker Facebook like news stories, you know, podcast called We're All Gonna Die, recording in cemetery, and they died. In a lightning storm, yes.
So, yeah. But anyway, what were we talking about?
Teaching.
I'll finish that thought. I was teaching, I started about 1997, and like I said, it was all based upon word of mouth and no real advertising or anything, and to date, now I have, it always fluctuates between like, you know, 20 and 30 students full-time, part-time, that kind of thing. And it's really interesting because I never took a lesson at all. Now I'm giving lessons.
Oh, wow. So that's like sort of like you learned this sort of organic way.
Yeah, I learned, you know, we're both from the MTV generation, per se. And when I learned guitar in the 80s, I didn't have the luxury of having tablature to learn from or I don't consider it to be spoon-feeding, but I think that when you have to learn all on your own, it makes you very strong in the ear and through feel and rhythm.
Yeah.
And I actually developed perfect pitch hearing, at least some aspect of that, because there's a lot of different types of pitch hearing that people can develop. And I think that's attributable through having to learn things by ear and watching finger placements and stuff like that. But that was an F sharp you just heard in that thunder.
Yeah.
So you see how it has immediately paid off.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah. So does F sharp mean deadly lightning? Or
No, because I think it's still pretty far away.
That's good.
You know, but if it gets to around like B, that's getting pretty tight. So we'll have to watch. We'll have to gauge that. We'll see what happens.
Yes. And so, you know, what you just said reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary about the band The Minutemen.
No, what's it called?
We Jam Econo.
Okay.
And talk about people sort of learning organically.
Mm.
For the first, like, year or so that D. Boone and Mike Watt played together, or were just kind of a jam in the bedroom, they didn't understand what tuning was.
Mm.
They just thought that those pegs were, like, some guys liked it tight. And some guys liked it loose.
Yeah. So feel then.
Yeah. So it's absolutely feel. And, but you listen to that band and there's still nothing that sounds like that band.
Right on. Well, yeah.
You know, which is kind of amazing.
That's always amazing because really, I mean, fundamentally speaking, we're all different as human beings. Everyone's created differently. I always like to harken back to Mr. Rogers, what he always said. And I don't remember the exact quote, but you know, we're all different and we're supposed to celebrate that because it makes life more interesting. And when you have that to bring into your musicality, originality is often a benefit and a result.
Yeah.
So whatever it takes to get to that point of pure expression, I'm a fan. We're getting closer here, aren't we?
It's raining pretty hard now.
Move it in a little tighter here.
There we go. I think the laptop's under. We're good.
Okay.
I'm not, but it's okay.
Do you want another umbrella? Do you have one in the car?
I might, but I'm going to weather the storm, so to speak, and keep going, because I think that brings us, though, to our main topic, which is this issue of genre, this issue of everybody's different, yet so much, at least I think commercial music, or commercially sort of produced music, fits in this tiny little box, and what the hell is that about?
There's a bunch of little boxes, parcels et al. I think that's the correct expression. When you have genres that are pervasive in an art form, it makes it a little more easy to sell the material, not only just for big, ridiculous record companies that profit off of artistic expression, but also for the artists themselves, which is the most, maybe not tragic, element of that.
Oh, no, that's tragic.
The most tragic element of that is that, then.
Yes,
no, it
is.
Because, really, we all have the power to do what we want. I mean, some people don't choose that because I don't think they have enough faith in really what they're all about, truthfully. So they feel they have to fit into that genre, fit into that mold, try to sell their music, try to make it, quote unquote.
Yeah.
The biggest misconception is, as an artist, that it's either feast or famine. And when you have that kind of precluding notion, what happens is you feel that you have to either go for the golden prize or just be a starving artist. And it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
You know, you can espouse your own originality and still make a living. Like I said, I mean, like I teach lessons. I'm at the high school level and I still write and record and I perform live.
Yeah.
You know, we can all find what we want to do within our art form without being slave to the genre.
Yeah. And I think, too, I mean, it's also, you know, maybe a product of, I mean, I guess about now, I mean, we live in the era where maybe does recorded music have any monetary value anyway?
Probably not.
You know, I mean, it's the 99-cent download that the artist, I think, in some cases with iTunes, is half a cent that they see from that, or whatever, you know, trading or whatever the hell happens on the internet.
Well, when you get into that as well.
Streaming services, it's weird, you know, that is there this new model where, instead of being a rock star, you just make records for your own pleasure and excitement and enjoyment.
Mm. Which should be that.
And your own pride.
Yeah. Live, though, you know how that extends, though. I mean, like, you have a high school mentality still amongst groups of people where, you know, if you listen to metal, you shouldn't listen to country. If you listen to country, you shouldn't listen to funk. If you listen to funk, you shouldn't listen to progressive rock. And on and on and on.
Yeah.
And people never seem to graduate high school. And it's a problem because, you know, again, we were born to express ourselves and to, you know, embrace our differences.
Yeah.
And music should be one of the chief highest forms of that. And and yet it always gets thrown into that, the bed of that flatbed truck of, well, you know, you gotta do this, you gotta do that, so you don't alienate these people, so you don't offend this group.
Yeah.
And it's when has art ever been a popularity contest? You know,
I think when it got commercialized, when when you had an industry that was still viable, you know, lollygagging to get out of bed this morning. The VH1 Classic was happening. It was like, oh, it's the 80s at 8, whatever. Well, the 80s, that was a decade that I lived through.
Yeah. And living through again.
And living through again, as we all are.
Well, they want you to keep buying the music, you know.
Yeah, they want you to keep buying in some new format or something. But they had Depeche Mode was on, you know, Personal Jesus. And my strongest memory or impression of that band now is, there was an interview the lead singer did with CMJ when I was still living here in Loretto, so it was the late 90s. You know, when that band was at its zenith of popularity, the record label had to spend $5,000 a week to have a psychologist tour with the band to keep the lead singer together.
Wow.
And the thought of being is, you know, like, remember back when record labels had money to throw it crazy? You know what I mean? Or just had money, period, you know, where it was just sort of like, well, we got to solve this problem. We need a hit. Well, get that guy, get the touring psychologist, get the, you know.
Well, it went from party favors to mind altering, organically, you know. Well, no, I guess it's not organically. I don't know, but more organized, I think.
Yes.
You know, because you can consider a drug being you know, something to placate the artist, and then you can
consider
the psychiatrist as just a more sophisticated way, i.e. a more controlled way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, maybe acid isn't quite as controllable.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just this thought of like, wow, you know, there was a time when, yeah, I mean, if you had a couple hit singles or something, you were such a viable commodity. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that great Chuck Klosterman piece that came out after Lutalica came out.
Okay, is that the Lounge Metallica thing?
No, the Lou Reed Metallica album, Lulu.
Oh, yeah.
And saying about how, you know, maybe some people, you know, the blasphemy of maybe some people do benefit from being on a major label.
Mm.
Because then their music is economically viable.
Right.
You know, and if it was economically viable, Lutalica wouldn't have happened. You know, it would have been, yeah, listen, we're just going to get Bob Rock here, and you're going to hammer out 12, you know...
medley commercial,
Yes, Black Album to whatever.
That's where it all went downhill for me. Yes. I mean, like, I don't know if you share the same opinion.
Oh, me too, but at least, you know, I mean, did you try to listen to Lulu?
No. Is it good?
No, it's... but it's... it's like a good M. Night Shyamalan film, or a latter-day M. Night Shyamalan film.
Is that possible?
In that it's remarkable in how dysfunctional it is.
Right.
Yeah, you know what I mean? In a world where most things just kind of work.
Yeah.
You know, like, you expect your car, it just, you turn the key, it goes, you go to Applebee's, the cheese fries taste the same everywhere.
Of course.
That you could have something that is commercially produced that is utterly dysfunctional.
Right.
Is...
that's kind of
amazing
good.
To me. I mean, yeah. It's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pay money for it, but, you know, but would the world be a better place if, you know, instead
hey,
of,
you're
you know,
finding
Black
a silver
two.
Lining. You're finding a silver lining.
I'm finding a silver...
as we get struck by lightning.
As we get struck by lightning.
Yeah, it's like directly above us now, everybody. Yes. Can you hear that?
Yeah, and I'm waiting for the hail.
Yeah. Should we keep going?
Yeah, let's keep going. We got umbrellas. The laptop's dry. The mic's dry.
Do we have protection from God?
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe you do. I don't know.
I don't know, man. Yeah. You can't speak for yourself on that. All right.
Yes. Okay. Even though I work for a Catholic university.
Well, that could be a detriment, actually. Yes. No,
oh.
I'm just kidding. I went there, too.
Yes.
You know.
But yeah, so this whole thing about people being, like, sort of constrained by it must be this, it must be what I liked in high school, nothing new can happen, you know, kind of thing. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the band The Pixies, but
never listened to them much. I mean, I'm very, very aware of them, obviously, being a musician. How can't you be? I mean, they're well respected.
Yeah. You know, there's this whole thing, no matter what Frank Black does, the rain is now getting harder if you can't tell.
You think? We have this omnidirectional mic picking up everything.
Wow, my pants are so...
Hey, if you want to call a rain delay, should we have a rain delay, or we can stick this out?
We don't need no damn rain delay on.
All right.
This is a tough podcast, man.
Oh, this is like the toughest, man. We're earning our bread on this one.
Yes. So no matter what he does, you know, they had that great album in 89, Doolittle.
Uh-huh.
No matter what Frank Black, Francis, whatever the hell he wants to call himself, does, every review I've ever read, like, since then has been, yeah, that's great, but it's not this thing that he did once.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a good record, but wouldn't it be great if the band got back together, and then when the band did get back together...
they did something like they did back then that they liked? Their favorite album, you mean? The columnist?
Actually,
I think that's what they're getting at.
That's the problem. Okay. The new record is not...
but I'm saying that's what the columnist is getting at.
Yes.
Is they
like,
want to
yes,
relive
still,
that glory day.
Yes, exactly, you know? Which is... I don't know, frustrating and weird, but I come at it from this other angle, and that is as a teacher of writing. And as a teacher of writing, you know, sometimes I teach students, you know, that genre can be liberating in a weird way. You know, I remember when I tutored, especially, a lot of times I would say, yes, but that's what the form does. That's the 5-paragraph essay. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just have to load up the cart and push.
Right.
Which is, I think, the double-edged sword of genre, right?
Yeah, the way I can relate to that statement is... I had done genre-specific bands in the past where we do cover tunes. In fact, most recently, I performed in a band called Dino and the Emotions back in the mid-90s for a couple of years, and it was a 50s band.
Yeah.
And we actually did our first gig in 17 years this past weekend in a show to honor the passing of my mother, who passed away last year. And that was her favorite band that I performed in. And when you have a genre limitation, it allows for a little more focus, at least live speaking, because I got my slap back delay.
Yeah.
I got my hollow body guitar. I have my 65 Deluxe Reverb amp. And I'm not stomping on pedals all night. I'm not trying to tap into what the vibe is of the next song, because you know what you're going for.
Yeah.
So you can still create within that. You know, it's a lot easier, a lot more comfortable,
yeah,
I think, whenever you have a genre. You don't worry about the music stand. If it gets wet, that's okay.
Yeah.
Just as long as the microphone's okay.
Yeah.
But I think it's clearing up a little bit. What do you say? To your left, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't worry about that music stand.
Yeah, well, I think it's actually ricocheting water onto us.
Yeah, that's more practical.
Okay. Yes. which I think there is something interesting to say, though, about the way that a genre or a style, too, though, can invoke a feeling, invoke an aesthetic, invoke an emotion, you know. I think that was, you know, the first time I ever really thought about aesthetics at all was through music and thinking about bands and how, like, that there was a sound and a look and a style, which in and of itself is fascinating.
Well, I think if it's done to the hilt, and I think if it's done from the heart, with good songwriting, and with real musicianship, rather than just a springboard to get your message out there, I think that that's possible. We had mentioned Metallica before. Metallica is a great example for their first four or five albums before that dreaded Black album. Basically, like you said, you had the aesthetic of the clothes, of the sound. At some point, you got to move on. And when they did move on, it wasn't for the right reasons. And I think bands can be educational like that. Like they can take their audience to a new place. And I think Led Zeppelin did that really well. They did the blues rock thing on the first two albums, and it sprinkled a little bit into three. But then they got acoustic, and then they did a little bit more of that, and more boldly adventurous with other, you know, movements and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's a good start. I think that if you're doing it for the sake of being, you know, safe to your crowd, though, that you're losing the whole point. So I do agree with you that there can be periods of genre-specific qualities to music. Now, myself personally, I don't really ascribe to that, because there's just so much that influences me. I don't know how I could possibly, you know, just create a sound and stick with it. I think that it's kind of anarchic for me in that way, and I like it because maybe fusing the styles is my style.
Yeah.
You know?
Which brings me to, do you remember the first time we ever hung out?
Was it at your place in St. Francis or at Menta's?
Yes, it was at my house in Loretto. And, Mr. Geschwind introduced us. He came over.
Uh-huh.
And the instant I knew I would like you, you saw that I had, at the time, it was only one shelf full of vinyl. I now have... somebody asked me this last summer.
More than a shelf.
More than a shelf.
Yeah.
If she asked, a friend of mine asked, well, okay, well, if you put it end-to-end, how many feet? And I did the calculation, and I think it'd be 24 feet of vinyl.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's...
So, like, bunched up vertically?
Or bunched up vertically.
Whoa! That is quite the sleeve.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. But you just saw that little... I was like, oh, can I look through these records? I was like, sure. And,
Beatles?
There were some Beatles in there.
Yeah, I remember seeing those.
But what it was,
You had the Greatest Hits Beatles, though. I do remember that. The red and the blue.
Red and the blue.
Right. I do remember that first encounter, then.
Yes, but the thing that was like, oh my god, this guy's awesome, you saw I had Aha Scoundrel Days, which is not the record that Take On Me is on. It's the one afterwards.
Right.
And you made a comment about it, and I told you my story was I had heard it as part of the MTV Europe Countdown when they did like... A 30-second, like, dude, you're a part of the world, you know, because that's what MTV used to do when they sold music was, it was never this good, it's your thing, and it's never been this cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was like, MTV's gone global.
Hype.
And I heard, this clip of this song called, Turning Away, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I was like, yeah, you know, this is like the epic, Like, this is the attempt at, like, this Swedish pop epic that they made.
Other than Dancing Queen?
Other than Dancing Queen. But I was like, it was just this attempt at this 80s Swedish pop synth epic. You know, like, they were trying to make their mark on history. And you, without a hint of irony, was like, can we hear it?
Yeah,
I was like, I was like, dude, this guy gets it.
Yeah.
This guy gets some shit.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we
speak the same language.
Yes. Like, can we hear it? And I was like, yes. And I put it on, and I don't know if it had any effect.
I'm sure it did.
I'm Losing You. That's the name of the song, actually.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to, like, check my Spotify or something. Because I don't have any full a-ha albums yet. I mean, like, Take On Me is, for many reasons, an amazing song. I mean, the video, for one, you remember, of course,
oh, yeah,
whenever that came out. And just the way the guy goes through, like, 3 or 4 octaves on the chorus. Yeah. And then most recently,
Pro Tools.
Yes, this is true. They really didn't cut and paste that.
Yeah.
And most recently, a member of the San Francisco Giants. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the 2-time world champion San Francisco Giants in the past couple of years, and I'm sorry to rub that in because I'm wearing a shirt that details one of them right now.
Hey, my dad was a Giants fan.
Oh, then we have even more of a connection then.
Yeah, Bobby Thompson's actually, the Bobby Thompson home run in 51 was the last lucid conversation I had with my dad.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing because it's one of the greatest moments in sports history.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But anyway, so, like, most recently, I have a real affinity for a-ha's Take On Me because Michael Morse, who played for the Washington Nationals, is now, like, really doing well for the Giants as a free agent signee this year, and that's his walk-up song to the plate. So it's the chorus. Look for it. He's really funny. He's a really quirky individual, and he's bringing some really coolness to the team, you know, and so he did so well the other day that it wasn't just the walk-up song. Like, he hit 3 straight doubles, and the last one was a bases clearing double, and he's standing on second base and they pumped it through the PA. Not even in his walk-up song. Like, the public address announcer was like, yeah, I'm just gonna play it now, and then the whole place just went crazy and gave him a standing O.
That's awesome.
You see how a-ha transcends art, sports, life globally.
Globally, yes. And they were huge in Europe. They had tons of hits in Europe. But that one little moment, you know, which I think, again, just goes to show, at least when music was commercial, or what is now commercial music, you know, people will buy what's being sold.
Mm-hmm. There's no excitement to it anymore to me, though. Honestly, yeah. I thought there was more of, I could get to pop music more.
Yeah.
Back whenever it was more of an explosion or a movement going on. I can't remember. I don't think that there's been a movement since the alternative grunge movement, which of course had its cliches. Every one of them has them.
Yeah,
but
I
think
that's really bad. Yeah.
That's the last one that I think that I could hang my hat on and actually watch MTV or listen on the radio for something. There's just no excitement these days. Maybe I'm a curmudgeon old taciturn fool.
I think for me, the excitement is now a sort of word of mouth.
Yeah,
is sort of like, there's a weird intimacy, you know, since people don't give a shit. I mean, the best show I've seen this year so far, it was a $5 show at Mr. Roboto. And there was this guy named Douglas Fir. And it was a banjo and a kick drum. And that's what he had.
Interesting.
And that was it.
One man show.
One man show. He's got records out with, like, sort of a backing band. But it was so compelling. And this guy just comes out and sings like he's dying. Like, it's like he's got a gun to his head or something. Like, if I don't get these notes out, I might die.
Wow.
And it was just like,
I've actually felt like that time from time.
Yes.
more like I'll kill myself if I don't sing this note right.
Yes.
That's more where I was coming from.
Yeah, but he was just, you know. And he's got this song called Goddamn, 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 Hallelujah.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, Goddamn, God. And it was like, fuck. And this was like, he was the second guy out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It wasn't even the headliner. It was this $5 show at this, like, vegan anarchic punk collective in Garfield. And it was just like, fuck. And I, like, went up to the guy afterwards, and I had, like, my rock star geek moment.
Yeah.
Okay, can I buy your record? Oh, which is the one that has all the songs. And I was like, it was almost like one of those, like, I got nothing to say to this guy. But
how did he react? Because I have a similar story. I want to hear how he reacted first. I'm going to share mine.
Weirded out by it, I think.
Yeah.
He was just, and I gave him $10. Like, that's, got $10.
When he was weirded out, though, did he say anything, like, kind of like, thanks? Or did he joke around?
Yeah, that's what it was. It was, yeah, thanks. Yeah, says that one's, well, that one's got all the hits on it, I guess. You know? You know what I mean? And that's what he said. And then it was just like, and it was sort of like, thanks, but please stop talking to me.
My experience was in 1999 whenever I had seen Mr. Bungle in Pittsburgh. Well, before I was going in to see them. And this was, I'm a huge Faith No More fan.
Oh, yeah. Talk about a genre-defying band.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. I mean, like, it started with me with Led Zeppelin, and then there's seeds of it with Elton John also, you know, just cross-pollinating and being fearless enough to not worry about how his fan base would accept it. You listen to the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album, and that album has at least 10 different styles. You go from, like, a show tunesy, campy, kitschy thing, like Sweet Painted Lady, to the epic ballad Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, to a more heartfelt ballad like Candle in the Wind, to the my favorite song of all time, Funeral for a Friend, Love Lies Bleeding, which I think is the finest musical composition ever created. Well, for me personally, you know, I mean, but there's I love Bach, too, so maybe I'm, you know,
Bach's contradict.
Right. Yeah, he's a good guy.
He got some good stuff together.
You know, I kind of like him. But anyway.
That old toccata and fugue thing, love it.
That's my favorite, actually, from him, toccata and fugue in D minor. But anyway, so all these genre blasting bands, like those three being chief among them, Faith No More took it to a more of an extreme. You could just see that they wanted to obliterate any notion of genre and just do as much as possible to thrust the middle finger to conservative music listeners. And like I said, you know, like we said, there is some purity and there's some goodness to genre-specific things. But, you know, I believe in the spirit of rock and roll, the spirit of rock and roll that is following your own bliss. That's the whole point, going against the norm, going against what your parents think. You can take that to more of an nth degree within the genre of people who don't do rock and roll. That's more rock and roll to do not just rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what Faith No More did. So I'm standing out there. Back to the story.
Yes.
And
good segue. Good segue.
Thank you. And I'm not good at those usually. I just ramble on as if you couldn't tell already. But I'm a little nervous.
Of the podcast. Yes. If it wasn't for people rambling on, this wouldn't like be episode 21 or whatever.
And I'm nervous from the thunder, but it's dissipating, so we're all right.
It's dissipating. I think the sun's coming out.
And then Mike Patton and I are standing there. Oh. Out of the blue, he walks out the side door. And I see him there, and I'm like, you know, fanboy, of course.
Yeah.
And I walk up, and, you know, it's just the torrent of over-the-top, you know, platitudes. Oh, you're I love everything you've done. You're the most amazing musician, this kind of thing. I think more like I'd say I appreciate everything you've really done. But, of course, he could read in my face what, you know, the fanboy thing.
Yeah.
And he looks at me, nonplussed, with a cigarette, and says, well, maybe you ought to go relieve yourself. No. Boy, the look on your face, I'll never forget that. And I'm so glad I never told you that story because I will never forget that pause and that look on your face because that was just amazing. And it has justified this day for me. I don't know if he meant, you know, urination or excrement, excreting, like to put a defecating, like relieving myself that way. Or, you know, a more R-rated of relieving yourself. You know, course, you know, because I'm like gushing all over the place.
Yeah.
So I stood there like you did. I just burst into laughter. And he started laughing himself. And we started talking a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was a little better after that because I didn't get it at first. And he's just such an intelligent guy. He can be really abrasive, as you know, as Wolf Mother knows.
Yes.
But they deserve it.
Yes, absolutely.
And most people that he is to does deserve it as well. But he can be pretty you know, elitist and rude with certain things. But he, again, you said about the aha thing. He and I had a moment, you know, because he knew I got it. He knew that I understood what was up. And I also remember asking him, well, what's up with Faith No More? And then he just was like, done. And it was like cold as a tombstone finger.
Oh.
You know what I mean? And but again, it was okay toward the end. I got his he agreed to sign my autograph. You know what I mean? Like he could have said, no, get the heck out of here, punk, you know? And then went in and saw one of the greatest shows of my life. They were all wearing like tiki shirts and it was during the album California, you know? And
that record is amazing.
Totally amazing, you know? Yeah. And that's another great genre-defying record. Yeah. I think the thing that I like most about that one is the fact that it was smoother in its genre-defying moments because you have something like Disco Volante, which is so abrupt, and you have these
schizophrenic.
It's 180. They turn on a dime, okay?
Yeah.
But California really is where they took those skills and made them more song-worthy and made them easier to listen to, which was natural because you can tell they weren't coming from a pop sensibility.
Oh, yeah. No, they,
It's like their beat, it's like when they were kind of like the Beatles, you know, because it just, it really flowed. So that was my moment with Mike Patton.
That's great.
You know, and back to what you said, and just to kind of conclude what we had been talking about, you know, being excited about a new song, the buzz thing. Like, I've always been about that. Like, being, hearing about or seeing in a magazine without hearing it or without seeing it. I think what takes it a step further from that, though, is actually seeing it somewhere. And then, like, for example, like 24/7 Spies I got onto. Then I'd see their video on MTV.
You know,
and bands like Pantera, that was the first... I was the first person probably in my hometown that ever listened to them, and they blew up. And then just the... You just feel justified. Like, I'm contradicting myself because it really should just come from the heart. But you just feel so good whenever you get into something and then everyone else starts to get notice of it and they start to dig it. And it blows up. But you don't have that as much anymore. Like, it just...
There's no mainstream anymore. There's no... There's, you know, there was a great editorial in Magnet Magazine a few years ago that said about, you know, it's like trying to follow pop culture now. Instead of there being sort of mainstream and then the stuff that was anti... You know, it's funny, the last podcast I did was with Mike Siemens, and the guy who owns Mindcure Records in Polish Hill. And we were kind of talking about the same thing. He was saying about how, you know, you can't even hate stuff anymore. Because it's not like it's being jammed down your throat. It's not like, you know, when I lived here and there was that station Quick Rock and I would just want to go buy some milk. And I'd be subject to, you know, Glycerine by Bush.
Oh.
And just, you know, like, ah! You know, like, and just feel like I was on fire.
Oh, that's so bad. Such a bad song.
Oh, I mean, such a bad band.
Gavin, if you ever hear this, you know, you could have done a lot better, man. I mean, beautiful wife.
Yeah.
Other than that, not much to hang your hat on.
No, anyway. You know, and it would just be shoved down your throat, like being force-fed. And
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you must listen to this.
And so you would retreat to, or I would retreat to whatever was mine.
Exactly.
And I think we all live in this world, it's mine. And maybe you tell your other music geek friends about it. But in terms of there being that thing that you must have to always listen to or die, you know.
Yeah, what is that anymore?
That's gone. That's out everything there. I mean, Miley Cyrus exists, but...
She's not even worth criticizing because it's so obvious that it's horrible.
Yeah, and honestly, you know what I mean? Like, I think I have an idea in my mind what that sounds like. I don't even know if I know what that sounds like.
Right.
I don't know if I've ever heard a Miley Cyrus song.
Exactly.
I heard a Taylor Swift song once. I was at the waiting room at the dentist's office. That was like, I heard it. I was like, oh, well, that's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or Adele was at the Oscars. Or,
right.
You know, just so many of those... One Direction. Like, I know what that sounds like.
Yeah.
But I've never heard that.
Yeah, you can't... I mean, like, at least, you know, we're talking about the past and pop movements and mainstream and whatnot. At least you knew what that song sounded like. You cared enough to listen to see if your song would be coming up. And then you would know why you hated that song.
Yes,
so we don't know why we hate these artists, but we do. You know? And it's kind of like, again, like you take it to like the collective consciousness of people these days. It's like, it's just the zombification of America.
Yeah.
You know, people really aren't expressing themselves anymore. People don't care. It's just the one-upsmanship all the way, all around. And people don't care about expression like they used to.
Yeah. Even the hate. I mean, I'll give you a great example too. In the classroom, not to get on the "those kids today" thing.
No, I'll do it. I'll do it all day.
Those damn kids.
I got kids.
They're great,
too, so
actually. They're great. My students are great. I love my students, but you know, I do have these moments where I realize, like, wow, it's a different generation. You know, I had them when I first got in the classroom 8 years ago, and I still have them now. I showed my students American hardcore. I had this class of American underground literary and pop culture movements. So we did the Beat Generation, the Black Arts Movement, punk, cyberpunk, and Riot Girl. And so I showed them, for punk, I showed them the documentary American Hardcore about, you know, Black Flag, Husker Du, Minutemen, SOD, all of those bands, Bad Brains, you know. And there was so much to be said in that documentary. People were saying about how much they were rejecting the mainstream culture. And how the hatred of things was so much part of what drove that movement and drove that genre. And it was funny because it's also a genre that, yeah, from 82 to 85, biggest thing in the world. And by 85, it was done. It was dead. It was over.
Right.
Because it was so, it was such a small corner to paint oneself into.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and so they couldn't understand that. They couldn't. Well, how could you just hate something? How could people hate music?
Really?
Yeah, that was a hard thing for them to get.
Wow.
Because, but then again, they, and I was talking to Mike about that, and he, you know. Because
hate's a natural emotion?
Because hate's a natural emotion, but also, you know, they don't have that ubiquitous force jamming things down their throat and force-feeding them culturally. Because you make a Spotify playlist, and it's only, it's you start with a band you like, and then you only play bands that you like.
Yeah.
You know, or bands that sound like the bands you like, which is also the most limiting, horrible, genre-specific thing in the freaking universe.
That's a really good point. I never even entertained that notion, is the fact that everything is at your fingertips and you can reject it as quickly as I just, you know, snap my fingers.
Reject it, block it out. I mean, I used to do even an exercise, you know, what's your personal top five right now? What are the five songs, bands, movies, TV shows, books that you're reading right now, games that you're playing? And it was amazing how, when I first got in the classroom in 03, it was, a lot of people would have things in common. No, I'm sorry, it was 05. Fall of 05, I got in the classroom first. People would have things in common. And now you have a room of fellow 18-year-olds who were born in the same year talking about things most of them didn't understand.
Mm.
And didn't even have that common connection to.
Right, right. So there's no unifying factor.
There's no unifying factor. There's just this kind of weird pastiche of...
Yeah. Consumerism.
Yeah. Personalized consumerism.
Right.
Tailored specifically for you. Nothing else matters.
There's so much complexity to it. I mean, like, I'm just, all these layers are unfolding within my mind about how we've gotten to this place, whether it's good, whether it's bad. And really, ultimately, at the end of it is just confusion. And you just kind of wonder whether that's all orchestrated, whether it's a machination. Because they say, if you can't convince people, confuse them. I think confusion's a pretty powerful force, even more than getting people to believe what you believe. Because it's more easily manipulative, in my opinion. You can go in more different ways with it.
Yeah.
So, hey, we got rid of the umbrellas, right?
Yeah, as the rain stopped.
I think we're good.
Just in time for the bottom five. Just in time for the final segment. The penultimate.
Perfect.
Segment. Yes. Okay, now it's time for the bottom five. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready, John?
Oh, I'm ready.
You ready? All right. Question one. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be?
Wow. Maybe I should have done my homework on disease. Oh, man. I don't know. Maybe chicken pox.
Ooh, chicken pox is a good one.
Because I had a horrible time with it, and I'd love to just inflict some of that power upon other hapless children. That sounds bad.
That sounds bad.
Maybe chickenpox.
Chickenpox is going, you know, and chickenpox, you know.
Speaking of which. Speaking of chickenpox.
You know, chickenpox has a great second act. It's called shingles.
I've had those too.
Yeah, there
under
you
my
go.
Arm, man.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. Painful. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a little bit. It wasn't
but
as bad
know,
as some
but
people get.
That's the second act. That's the comeback tour. That's the, you know, there are no. They say there are no second acts in American public life, but chickenpox.
The farewell tour,
that's,
maybe.
Maybe that's yeah. That's maybe the best. That's
it's
maybe
surrealism,
the best
man.
That question so far.
It's
all
surrealism,
right.
Baby.
All right. Question two. How would the world, or at least America, be different if the president was an artist rather than the Ivy League educated lawyer types we've been electing over the past 50 years?
I don't think it'd be different at all.
Really?
I don't think that the president controls anything. I think that I do subscribe to the puppet theory. I do. I don't think that I hate to be so defeatist and you know, I know some people are going to be like, oh, whoa, vote, man, rock the vote. I don't think you can rock the vote. That's my answer. Mm. Like, it's all in place.
Mm. All right, question three then. What is your most irrational pet peeve? The thing that sets you off, that shouldn't, rationally, it just shouldn't make you angry. It shouldn't, like, upset anyone. But yet, I'll tell you a couple of mine.
I have a ton. I'm just trying to pick the best one.
The best one.
Yeah, go. What's yours?
I know I've said this before on the podcast, but people who juxtapose itch and scratch.
Hmm.
I had a scratch, so I itched it.
Okay.
That is like, I will murder you in front of your family for that.
Well, that's going to unfold many avenues of pet peeves for me as well.
Yes. Yes.
I have almost no tolerance for the your, Y-O-U-R, Y-O-U apostrophe R-E.
Oh, yeah, crap. That does stick out like a sore thumb, yeah.
Also, one of them, probably the more obscure ones, is whenever people will go, aw, and they spell it A-W-E. So, really, does that mean that you're like, wow? Or do you mean, aw, so cute? So let's get it right. Cute, A-W-W-W-W-W, because people like to use 50,000 consonants to express themselves at the end of words these days for emphasis. Yep. And A-W-E is, wow, awesome. Get it? It's not that tough to figure out. So one of my real pet peeves other than that is just noise. Like when I'm at my house, and this is kind of, again, ridiculous because I'm a guitar player that likes to crank his amp and play. When I hear gunshots in the woods, whenever I hear just people outside my house, I go to the window. It drives me crazy.
Mm.
So I'm not very well adjusted at times. But we all have our pet peeves.
We all do. We all do. Another one for me is, as a snobbish urban dweller, is when people who live in a suburb but still consider their address to be the city.
Right.
They don't write in Mount Lebanon or Westview or whatever. They say Pittsburgh and then the zip code. That, for whatever reason, just like, no, you don't get the cultural capital, man.
Right.
I pay city property taxes. Fuck you.
Yeah.
You
know? Right. Yeah, and plus it just smacks of insecurity. It's like, yes. Do you really need to feel a part of a big name?
Yes.
Or does it matter? I don't think it matters.
I don't think it matters, but it does to some people.
You know?
Yes.
Anyway.
That's an irrational pet peeve. All right. Question four. Question four. What is one pop culture text or personal preference you wish more people did or knew about? If you could spread the gospel of whatever right now.
Are you talking about something that is a part of pop culture?
It could be a part of pop culture or...
Like what should... Hey, dig this, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
If you wish... Something you wish more people just got it.
I would just say it's not really just a pop cultural thing. I'd say, again, I don't know. That might go against what the question's all about. Maybe you can help me here. There's simplicity at the root of all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I just wish that people would, again, get back to expressing themselves, get back to, you know, the things that make life worth living. You know, they say that the arts become irrelevant whenever you can't afford them. But we put ourselves in places to have to hire lawyers.
Yep.
You know, lawyers are not relevant. We make them relevant.
Yeah.
What do you appreciate about life? Expressing oneself, living life.
Yeah.
You know, being part of this world before you have to shuffle off the mortal coils. People get so bogged down by all the things that are just more tangible, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Like a garbage collector or a milkman or a rain or an umbrella that I need to unfurl again because we're getting bombarded once again.
Yeah.
But no, it's... A simple pop cultural thing like that is what's most important to me, is just being able to appreciate living and expressing and being yourself.
Yeah.
That's my grandiose soapbox pop culture thing.
Yes. That's a good thing to have.
Yeah.
All right. You ready for the last question?
I'm so ready.
All right. This is the Christopher Hitchens question.
Okay. He's the Englishman, right?
Yes.
Okay.
The Englishman.
He's been on Bill Maher.
Yes, and he's dead now. And in his
he
book,
is.
Yes, he died.
Oh, okay.
And in his book, Mortality,
we'll dedicate this one to his memory.
Yes, we'll dedicate this question to his memory in a Catholic cemetery in Loretto, Pennsylvania. He talked about how when he first realized that he had this fatal diagnosis, he immediately was like, "Oh, but I really hope that I get to read Henry Kissinger and Cardinal Ratzinger's obituary. Wait, I want to write those." And then those people are going to outlive him. So I ask you...
Oh, okay.
Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you like to write?
Wow.
If there was somebody, you know... If not obituary, how about instrumental rock opera? Stage show. The Faustian story of...
Well, define villain, though, because I have an affinity for villains, and most... Like the Joker.
Yeah.
But it all boils down to, do I care about these people that I hate enough to want to write a song about them?
Yeah.
You know, do you think it's something... Someone who is a true villain to me, someone that I hate, yeah. someone... Okay. That makes it easier, because then it could be a really good metal song. metal opera, as a matter of fact. I'd probably like to write a song about a CEO that I detest or despise. I just someone who's behind it all. I just can't put my finger on it right now. I'm trying to think of someone who really is a true villain, someone who does pull the strings.
Bill Gates, Sarah Schmidt of Google.
Yeah. How about Sam Walton? Oh, he's dead.
Oh, well, his kids.
Yeah. I'd love to write their obituaries or their rock opera. I think I'd go off on
the Waltons, like family private Learjet plane crash, maybe.
That would be nice.
They would all go out at once.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Because they took my mall away from my childhood. Richland Mall, you know, that was my favorite place. And, you know, then they swept in on their devil winged brooms and leveled the joint and put up all these other bastardized forms of American business and called it progress. So I think I'd love to write their obituary and or plane crash, i.e. Leonard Skinner-ish.
Yeah.
Type thing. Yeah, let's do that, man.
All right.
Wow, it took a little bit of prompting, but I got there.
Yeah, no, you went there quite well, actually.
Thank you.
That was an admirable answer.
Hey, man. Live music, live radio. Well, this is taped, but we went all the way through a thunderstorm.
Yes.
All live. Danelle starting the car briefly.
Yes.
The umbrellas unfurling, that kind of thing. So
I think there was the sound of like some sort of rattlesnake creature in the woods or something.
Yeah, it could have been
that. I heard, nature frightens me.
The Loretto Chupacabra.
Loretto Chupacabra. All right. Well, I think that's about it. We're going to sign out from the graveyard. Thanks, John, for being on here. So do you have a FaceTube how do we find out about your musical projects?
Currently, I have nothing.
You have nothing?
Nothing at all.
Suspended in
midair? I'm suspended in disillusionment and the people would actually care in the first place. And again, I hate to be so defeatist about, you know, the current record buying public or whatever it may be and all that kind of thing. But I know there are people out there who'd appreciate what I do, partly from self-preservation. Cause I've noticed that, you know, I've kind of shied away from things like that because, you know, just the disappointment of not wanting to be heard or that kind of thing. But not to go down another tangent I'm working on getting that together, though. I mean, like, right now I'm finishing my band Wine of Nails' album, which we started in 2010. And I can maybe play some samples for you before I go. Oh, awesome. Do you want me to play my guitar to close this out?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay.
But we're getting rained on again. Oh, my God. Okay. But anyway, no. Right now, it's just John Charney. I'm on Facebook. It's just Charney. Eventually, I'm going to try to get some things going on there. Maybe Bandcamp. I haven't really gotten that together yet, but the bands are Wine of Nails. John Charney with Gabby Herzog. We haven't come up with a band name yet because, you know, people around here just know us by name, so look for that, too. But, yeah, maybe we'll do a follow-up, and you can just say, well, this is how you can find out how to get John's stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
And you can hear one of my songs right now.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You want to hit pause, or if you want to just keep talking?
I will hit pause, and we'll play. Well, actually, how about this? I will hit pause.
Okay.
All right. So playing us out.
Okay, well, I'd like to dedicate this song to you, Matt, because I think you'll really appreciate it. It's from Lord of the Rings. It's actually a song entitled Minas Morgul, which is the city of the dead. You can at least dig to that.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
We're in a graveyard.
Okay. We are in a graveyard.
And it goes like this. Out of tune. ¶¶
That's finally about it.
You're now a fan of Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah, I've totally been converted in the last 3 minutes. Yes. I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new episodes and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on the iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook and Google+, because I'm an attention whore.
Oh!
Thanks to Brett Zorick, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.
Later.